I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. And this is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
G'day and welcome to another episode of Australian Golf Passport. I'm Scott Warren and I'm joined as always by Matthew Mollica. Hey, Matty.
Hi, Scott. Excited to launch into one of my favourite courses on earth in this evening's episode. Kingston Heath is a special place in Australia and lots of great stuff to talk about.
Wonderful, Matty. I know that you've been around it more times than you care to count, so it's going to be really great to hear some of your insights as someone who knows the course so well. Before we do get to Kingston Heath, a bit of news of the week. Matty, I know you'll be as excited as I am to hear that LIV Golf is confirmed to be coming to Australia late April 2023, playing in Adelaide. You must be booking your trip imminently.
I think I'm busy that week, Scott. I've got something planned down here. I've got a subsequent engagement, as my wife would say. No, a lot of Aussies will be excited. Maybe not quite as excited as the Premier of South Australia, but it's a good thing that we're seeing elite golf in the country. Prefer we see it in a different way, but at least we're seeing it. How do you feel about it?
I don't really feel anything about it. I think that's part of my problem with that whole product. You know, the ownership aside, what I do think is cool is that there was talk when Cameron Smith went to LIV that he had, part of his deal was that LIV Golf come to Australia, and he's quite well documented as the chief modern pro supporter of Australian golf. You know, Adam Scott and Jeff Ogilvie came here a lot in the off season from the PGA Tour. Jason Day came here barely. Cam Smith broke into the world top 100 in 2015 in the US Open. And since that time, he's played every single Australian Open, every single Australian PGA, and every single, rest in peace, the Australian Masters that was held after that point. So not only has he not missed a summer back home, he hasn't missed a single tournament. And I just think that's incredibly admirable. And so maybe the silver lining for me is, here's this young Aussie pro that wants to try to actually make Australian golf matter and get us on the map. And if part of his deal with Greg Norman and MBS was to do that for Australian golf, I think that's commendable for the bloke.
That's an amazing record, isn't it, when you stack that up against his peers?
It's not even closely challenged. I think, you know, it was about maybe 90% of the summers Scotty and Jeff Ogilvie were back here to play, often maybe one tournament. The fact that Cam's coming back, noting, look, he's got an American partner, he's got a home in Florida, he's got all the things other than children that all the other players sort of say, oh, well, I can't because, and to not even miss a single tournament. Often those tournaments aren't even that close together either, so it requires a bit of a stay. Maybe he's just the rare Aussie golf export that actually enjoys his home country.
Yeah.
That's great to see. So that's my silver lining for anything LIV related is focused on Cam Smith. So Grange, late April, couple of weeks after the Masters. I guess we'll see. You know, there's noise out of certain parts of the Australian golf family that people are so pumped about this because I finally get to see our great players play. And I guess the litmus test maybe comes at that event. You know, it's far enough in the future that people, if they're pumped for it, can travel from interstate. And if there's crowds there and there's genuine energy there, then fair play to them.
And they're talking about taking 9 holes from each of the courses at the Grange and making a composite. So they'll play a front 9 west, back 9 east, or vice versa, which will be a contrast in styles. Those two courses look a bit different. The west course clearly superior in my mind, but some people differ. Be interesting to see it on TV. Be interesting to see how guys like DJ and Patrick Reed make their way around there.
Yeah, we just don't get enough. We don't get enough professional golf here, and there's a number of reasons for that. But as staunchly as I just can't stomach LIV Golf, if they're going to bring a tournament here, that's more than the PGA Tour's really done. So you can hold a lot of things against them, but I guess credit where it's due. If one of the goals was to bring golf to Australia, it looks like they all have done it.
True. And our other little snippet for the week, you spied a picture of some of the work that has just been performed on the 17th hole at Commonwealth.
That's right. Yeah, I saw a picture snap up on Twitter, I think yesterday, which is the 14th of November, if people want to go back and try and find that. I think it might have been by Robert Peak, who I believe is a comp member. And it was sort of an elevated view down the short par 4 17th of the new green that Renaissance Golf Design has built. You know, it's exciting to see that work starting to roll out, Matty. I think a lot of people have waited a long time to see what might be possible there.
Yeah, I'm hoping to go there in the coming days and have a little bit of a look around and see what's been done and what they've got scheduled over the summer. Hopefully the start of a lot of great stuff for Commonwealth.
So. Yeah, I think so. And it's going to be a reckoning for a lot of Sandbelt golfers who, it seems to me, two things some Sandbelt golfers are quite passionate about. One is Doak and Renaissance's architecture, and two is hanging crap on Commonwealth at any opportunity. And so at some point, these people, you know, they're on a collision course. They're going to have to choose, what are they more passionate about? You know, they're more passionate about Tom Doak and this amazing new golf course, or are they going to look for a reason to still needle Com? Hopefully the former.
Hopefully the former. I'm sure it'll be the former.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be.
Now on to this week's main focus is Kingston Heath Golf Club. As people may be aware, Kingston Heath is about to host the Australian Open, Australian Women's Open, and Australian All Abilities Championship all in the 1 week in a kind of co-sanctioned event. The other host will be Victoria Golf Club, which we plan to review and profile next week before the tournament starts. But Kingston Heath will have the Thursday and Friday golf will be across the Heath and Victoria, and then the tournament moves to Victoria alone for the weekend after the cut. Just the latest, I guess, Matty, in a pretty rich tournament history for the Heath.
Yeah, the club's really proud of its tournament history. I think they've long been aware that it's been a bit of a responsibility of theirs to hold big tournaments, showcase their course. There would always be a feeling within the club that it's a great venue for professional tournaments. There's a fantastic mural inside the main entrance of the clubhouse when you go through the administration, a huge mural that was painted to mark the club's centenary back in 2009. And it's really a blend of lots and lots of different chapters of the people within the club's history. And there's little figures, there's little faces of each of the people who've won an Australian Open at Kingston Heath. Peter Fowler in 83, Gary Player back in the 70s, Norman in 95, Aaron Baddeley won the most recently staged Australian Open around the Heath tick over 20 years ago. Kari Webb's on that mural as well. We've had some other tournaments at the Heath more recently. Tiger Woods with his Australian Masters in 2009. So that occurred in the year that the club celebrated its centenary, and that was a big event for more than just that reason, with the week after being...
Yeah, the 9-9 through the passenger side door.
Yep. And then the Danes won a World Cup back over the Heath, as we alluded to at the start of the Metro episode last week. Søren Kjeldsen and Torbjørn Olesen won back in 2016 when it was held there. So yeah, lots and lots of professional events, but the first for a number of years with the Aussie Open making its way around the Heath. It'll be really good to see those strong fields play that course and see what it's like in this day and age. You've done some work on the headliners for the men's and women's fields, and it's a deeper field and it's probably higher quality at its top end than I realised.
Yeah, it's probably your classic good Australian Open, whereby there's probably a really strong top 10. And then it falls away reasonably steeply. But one of the things about Australian Opens is they seem to have quite often in recent years produced really strong winners and really exciting finishes. And maybe that is part of there being a couple of handfuls of possible winners, you know, barring a freak outcome. But Cam Smith, Minwoo Lee, Ryan Fox, Mark Leishman, Adam Scott, Cam Davis, Lucas Herbert and Matt Jones, you know, that's all have won on the tours they play on in the last year or so. There's a couple of major champions in there. There's some really good young players. And then on the women's side, there's Hannah Green, So-Yeon Ryu, Minji Lee, Ashley Buhai, who won the Open this year, Steph Kiriakou, Laura Davies, Curry Webb, G.I. Shin, who's a major champion, I think, a couple of times over, and Jennifer Kupcho. So on both fronts, there's a good group to be able to follow around and the promise, I think, of a good leaderboard come Sunday.
It should be a really, really good event. I know that Kingston Heath's looking near the best that it's ever looked, which is astounding given recent weather conditions. We had another deluge down here in Melbourne in the last 48 hours. So Kingston Heath's, well, the whole metropolitan Melbourne area has copped a soaking recently. So it's certainly not going to look as it would after it copped a lot of sun in a Melbourne summer. So we're not going to get baked out fairways or golden roughs, but it does look and play really, really fantastic at the moment, which is great.
That's terrific. I'm excited to see a bit of Sandbelt on the TV as the weeks tick over to Christmas, and it looks less likely that I'll see the Sandbelt with my own eyes this year. But there's a bit of a different routing that will be used that's been used traditionally for tournaments at the Heath. What's that look like, Matty?
Yeah, the club has a couple of different sequences that they can use, both for club events, 2-tee starts and 1-tee starts. And in recent times, they've sort of reverted to what members would call the outer and inner loops. We start on 7-tee, play 7, 8, 9, and unfortunately for TV viewers, we bypass 10, really just in the name of traffic control in that tight little area of the property. So bypass 10 and walk straight to 11-tee, play 11, and then cut through the tree line on a really, really short walk, go play 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And so that ends up with the front nine concluding under the eaves of the clubhouse, right next to the first tee. And then that back nine commences with 1 and 19, which we'll talk about in a second. You can walk straight off the back of that right to the 12th tee and then go play 12 through 18. So you have a traditional finish to around at the Heath. Starts off on a hole that members would play as a par 5, and I'm 99% sure that the guys will play 7 as a par 4, but the women will maintain par 5 status. It's a shame that 10 misses, but when you see the picture of the overhead that we put up on Instagram as a part of the podcast for this episode, you'll see that it just gets a bit too tight with crowd control around that area. There's a big confluence of 3 green, 4-tee, 8-tee, 10, and 10's only a really short hole. It's the shortest hole on the course for those who don't know it and who haven't been there before. Just too difficult to have that in the routing and have people move around that area. So yeah, unfortunately, it gets deleted from tournament routing.
And then going back to the start, I guess, to look at the golf course itself rather than just its place hosting this tournament in December, it's a bit of a story, a bit of a journey from Kingston Heath being founded to Kingston Heath where it is today. What's the kind of lineage of the courses that club's called home?
Yeah, Kingston Heath was one of the first courses and clubs in Melbourne. It dates back to 1909. There are a few other Sandbelt clubs that predated it, particularly Royal Melbourne and Metropolitan and Victoria. I think Kew celebrated its centenary a touch earlier than Kingston Heath from memory. But it's certainly one of the earliest courses in Metropolitan Melbourne. It was founded by a group who first started playing at Elstonwick, and that site has only recently ceased hosting golf. It used to be the site of Elstonwick Public. The club moved from Elstonwick to Cheltenham, its current location, in the early 1920s, and they'd commissioned Dan Suter to design a course for them. Dan Suter was a Scotsman who had come to Australia, was an illustrious figure in Australian golfing history, one of the founding professionals of the Australian PGA, won an Australian Open, designed a number of courses, wrote a seminal book entitled The Australian Golfer, published back in 1906. And I think his finest achievement was certainly designing and routing the course at Kingston Heath. Mackenzie visited Kingston Heath during his 1926 visit, famously wrote that it was a really, really good course and soundly constructed. It was unbunkered at that time. So there's a few courses of that era where holes were in play and some studies were made and bunkers constructed at a later time, depending on how the course played and where players were hitting their golf balls. So Mackenzie designed a bunkering scheme for Kingston Heath and made one or two other changes to the course at that time, most noticeably shortening the uphill par 3 15th, which used to play as a little blind drive and pitch hole, a short par 4 where you would drive over where that 15th green currently sits and then play a little dinky shot into the green from there. So that's probably his most significant change at Kingston Heath. And again, we'll put one or two great pictures of that par 3 15th hole up. That's really a highlight moment in anyone's round when they visit the Heath. Course was viewed a couple of different ways in its early days. It was really, really long, and it played to a bogey of 85 when it first started. The committee at Kingston Heath had given Dan Suter a pretty modest brief, and they'd really instructed him to build them a course that would stand the test of time. And this phrase, the test of time, is really intertwined with Kingston Heath's history. Their original club history book was entitled The Test of Time. There's a club song that includes those lyrics. Mackenzie made a little bit of a comment about the course length during his report to the club and said that it was quite long. And I think that he might even have suggested that they shorten two or three holes. The club, in their infinite wisdom, decided not to do that. The first, the sixth, the 17th were all considered par fives back in the day. And they're now long par fours. As we'll get to in a moment, it's not built on a big property. It's not built on a dramatic property, but it is really a course of rare quality. And I really hope that shines through when we see the course on TV at the end of November, start of December.
Yeah, I think that's I think that is the most remarkable thing. And hopefully that's evident people watching on TV. I feel a bit like Kingston Heath is almost an Australian version of, say, Merion, where it's got a real place in the kind of heart of the golfing community in that country. It's on probably not enough land and not necessarily show-stopping terrain, but just the golf that's been built is so good that it overcomes those limitations. I was thinking about this episode today and the fact that Kingston Heath is really the perfect club that any club that's looking to improve their course should go and visit, because it's not that you'll walk around and say, well, we don't have that land to build that hole, or we don't have the space, you know, the width to build these bunkers. But everything that Kingston Heath has done in the last 10 years has been these like incremental little tweaks where it matters and will be noticed. And in terms of maximizing potential, I just don't think there's a place I know that does it like Kingston Heath. Every small decision seems to be really well intentioned and then really well carried out. The place just gets better and better despite not seeming to change. It's those little things that change year to year that just get it up those little point one and point two.
Yeah, and that comes from the activities of the consultant architects. They've retained OCCM and now OCM for a long time. Head super and his staff. Presidents, captains, subsequent committees, they've been ahead of trends in so many areas, whether it's been vegetation management, as we heard Lucas allude to in the most recent episode. The club was acquiring land on its boundary back in the 80s and making sure that there was less of an issue regarding liability and more room for expansion. That Madden land, or the land that the club has developed into the little par three course, they acquired that back in the early 80s. Land to the west of the property bordering the 17th, purchased that and allowed for expansion with more practice facilities and a bigger range, and they'd move the boundary of the course away from residential fence lines. All those big and small decisions, they've just been soundly made and considered, and you look back and think, yeah, they did the right thing. Oh, that step was the right step. Oh, that little decision with the course turned out really, really well, and they've got every little bit of juice out of the lemon on, as you've said, a small plot of land, and they've enjoyed a course of great quality.
In terms of those incremental changes and the little bits of change to the golf course over the past, say, 10 years, how important do you think is the relationship between the super and his brother, being Ashley Mead, one of the principals of OCM? Do you think that's just that X factor of understanding and discussion and respect for achieving world class and pursuing world class, you know, an understanding between those two of what goes into that from both perspectives?
Yeah, I think that's got to help. I'm sure they would have discussed that course and tiny little tweaks or tiny little refinements that they may make. There's obviously been a lot that's already in place well before Hayden arrived. Yeah, but that would be one contributor, no doubt. The work that they've done from a ground staff perspective, just in mowing lines, course presentation, an evolving flora management program. That, yeah, those guys have done a brilliant job in maintaining and enhancing that course. The little aerials that you posted of two or three spots on Metro where you've got those beautiful green to tea walks where there's just an expanse of short grass and a great feel of transition from one hole to the next. I think that Kingston Heath's done that really, really well in so many spots throughout the course. I think they've led that trend in course presentation and turf management as well in the Sandbelt. And yeah, some of that's got to be attributable to Ashley and his brother.
There's, you know, that, I think to put a point on just how great that presentation of the course and all of the built kind of architecture is that there's quite a few golfers who visit Melbourne or who even are living in Melbourne that will argue till the end of the earth that it's a better golf course than RM West. You know, regardless of your view of, you know, whether it is or it isn't, the fact that that's even a conversation given the two canvases that they each started with is, you know, that really says it better than you ever could by calling out individual traits of the golf course. Is it has no right to even have that question asked.
Yeah, it doesn't have the drama of RM West's property, doesn't have the scale, and yet there's so many. Ian Baker Finch will go to his grave telling you it's a better course, I'm sure. And there's so many other pros and amateurs who come and visit and say precisely the same thing.
Yeah. Well, obviously, there was one famous decision made by Australian Golf Digest in 2010 when they ranked Kingston Heath ahead of Royal Melbourne. It's the first time Royal Melbourne had been usurped on any of the kind of main Australian lists. I'll just note that number two that year, Matty, was New South Wales Golf Club. So I think I've mentioned New South Wales in every episode, usually unintentionally, but there we go. We'll tick that off for this one. Yeah, so, I mean, that was a pretty controversial decision and probably in no small part drove, you know, that constant improvement that you've seen at RM West over the last handful of years with Renaissance Golf involved. Do you think that shook Royal Melbourne up a bit?
I think it probably accelerated the rate of change in response to the course conditioning that RM was suffering at that time. The drought seemed to affect Royal Melbourne more than most. Turf conditions really suffered around the West in particular, I can remember back at that time. I've got friends who will clearly state that fall in the rankings spurred a much more forceful and much swifter response from Royal Melbourne in trying to improve conditioning and get back to what they saw as their rightful spot. Having said that, it's Kingston Heath always ranks at the top of that or near the top of that list, I should say, in Golf Australia magazine. And that's despite the emergence of two courses at Barnboogle, Wickham. So that little process of continual improvement, they always seem to sort of defy gravity and stay pretty close to the top of that ranking despite the emergence of these new superstars. And they'll be under pressure when 7 Mile Beach opens as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe in Kingston Heath's advantage is that a lot of the new courses that have opened are that seaside, linksy, windswept style of golf. You know, they're not building Kingston Heath again anywhere else. You know, we've talked about, you know, the limitations and constraints. There's not going to be another Kingston Heath open in Australian golf. And I think maybe it's just that thing that it represents the pinnacle of something that these other courses arguably might be better. You know, if you were to score them, try and objectively score them. But there's something about what Kingston Heath presents and the juice that it squeezes out of a small lemon that provides that magic that the new stuff's great. But yeah, it's Kingston Heath isn't Barnboogle Dunes, but Barnboogle Dunes, you know, isn't Kingston Heath in a lot of ways too. So yeah. I love seeing it stick up there as that, you know, the little course that could.
Yeah, it's defying that trend. I think a lot of visitors that come from overseas and play Kingston Heath probably fall in love with the bunkering. You were talking about Metro giving people a quintessential taste of Sandbelt aesthetics and bunker appearances, and Kingston Heath does that too. The bunkering's probably of greater number at Kingston Heath as well. There's a few holes where there's big expanses of sand that amazingly don't feel out of place or out of scale despite the small size of the property. I think that's one of the reasons why people will travel from the UK or the US and fill in their little ballot forms with world ranking panels and put Kingston Heath right up in the top couple of dozen. And they'll be struck by that aesthetic character of the course and sometimes the strategic nature of that bunkering as well. It's not always strategic. There's little spots around the course where it's potentially bordering on eye candy more than strategic purpose, but it's still, yeah, it's still there and still striking. So
the thing I love about the bunkers at Kingston Heath is they're smaller individually, but clustered together to make the appearance of bulk sand, where we talked about the small scale of the land, you know, a huge bunker might overwhelm, but three bunkers tied in so nicely together essentially looks like one bunker more or less, but it just provides that smaller scale of the architecture. It's as good an example as anyone's going to find.
That's a great point. And you see it from the first tee shot of the day, that string of bunkers down the right side of that first fairway that separates the first and sixth. There's no bunker on the property that's as big as a bunker, say like 10 West. There's no four at Barnboogle Dunes bunker at Kingston Heath, but there's significant swathes of bunkers down the left of 17, on the inside of two. There's bunkering that is pretty sizable around the 15th green as well, but strings of smaller hazards combined to great visual effect, as you said.
And we've talked previously about the notion of Kingston Heath being flat, but maybe not so much. And, you know, for me, I look at 7 of the 11 holes play over significant undulation. There's, you know, a couple of blind drives in there. There's a good amount of movement of, you know, that 6 to 8 feet, you know, that's where some of the best golf is found. I think it is a bit of a misnomer. I mean, granted, the other 11 holes are billiard table flat, but that just, for me, it's enough holes that I wouldn't, you know, I think you're kind of using artistic license to call it a flat golf course.
Yeah, even that small scale movement, if you hit your drive long enough down the first, you'll crest a tiny little rise and won't see it bounce, and you won't be 100% sure where it's finished. And it's not a big rise, but it's enough to complicate things visually. There's one dominant ridge on the property, and I should probably try and get the graphic skills going before I try to post this on socials. But there's one dominant ridge on the property that sort of extends from the west of the plot almost down to its eastern boundary. And I had a really interesting discussion with Mike Cocking years and years ago about how Kingston Heath was routed. And we sort of saw some little flaws with it and thought, oh, you wouldn't necessarily route a course this way if you were starting from scratch today. But that ridge, that one major topographical feature that makes its way through that property, gets used on the front nine and the back nine in myriad different ways. That seventh green is sort of benched into it. You have a blind drive over it on eight. Your tee shot traverses it on nine. There's bunkering cut into it as you play down 14. 15th green is benched into it. You've got a blind drive over it again on 16. And then you've got a blind approach in this really iconic hole on 17. So you hit your second shot over that rise to a front-to-back sloping green of significant size. So that one feature, it gets used again and again in a couple of different ways at various times throughout the round really, really well. And you certainly, as you said, you'd walk over that southern portion of the golf course and you'd think, this is not flat.
No, absolutely not. And I think what really matters too is you've got the first hole and then some flat ground, then 6, 8, and 9 all have significant undulation. Again, a little string of flat ground golf, and then 15, 16, 17. So you've got it drip through the round. We talked last week about Metro. What sort of interesting land it does have is done by the sixth hole. Royal Sydney's another great example of, you know, there is some interesting land, but you play on it from the first through the seventh and then you're off it. I like the fact that not only have the architects got 7 holes over this feature to maximize its impact on the round, but that it's been spread around the routing. It's not just go to it, play all around it, and then leave it.
Yeah, and you sort of see that with routings that Bill Corr does on coastal sites, where he'll give you a bit of a taste, go away, come back, go away, builds towards a crescendo, and you're invariably pretty close to the coast when you play your final 2 or 3 holes. And that ridge has a similar sort of presence throughout the round at Kingston Heath, which is really neat.
It's funny, after we published our New South Wales episode, we had a comment on Instagram from someone saying that it's a terrible routing. You should play 5, 6, 7, then 13, 14, 15, 16 along the cliffs. And obviously that would mean one visit down to the shore in the middle of the round. And I just thought it's funny how, you know, for me, the incredible thing about that is how dotted out the holes on the ocean are. But to somebody else, it's not great because there isn't this all world hour and a half kind of journey down the coastline. Yeah. And yeah, it's interesting the different things that jump out to different people. But certainly for me, you know, the fact that I'm not using up all the interesting land and then playing flat golf for 12 holes, I think that's real a testament to Kingston Heath.
I think the other badge of honour it wears really well is that it does a lot with those flat holes. I have a particular soft spot for holes on courses where the land just doesn't really seem like it should hold a tremendous lot of interest, and yet there's a fantastic hole over it. And 16 at Lost Farm does that. I think that great little short par 3 13th at Royal Melbourne West does that. The short par 3 10th Kingston Heath, the short par 4 3rd at Kingston Heath. Like, they're sort of football fields, really, soccer pitches. Yeah. And that built architecture and the nous that's gone into a green complex, a little bit of geometry, hazard placement, tilt of a putting surface, they've made something remarkable on those otherwise unremarkable stretches of land.
Yeah. It's telling that when you ask people their favourite holes at Kingston Heath, quite a lot of those flat holes are the holes that get mentioned, you know, 10 and 3 particularly. I know a lot of people, you know, are big fans of 11 as well. And you would think that if there were 7 holes that had the undulation and the rest were flat, well, those 7 would be highlight holes. But really, you know, when you look at the holes that people rave about at Kingston Heath, 15 is the only one that's really heralded that's on the undulating land.
People love that little 10th, seems to be what most people take photos of during their round. Interestingly enough, I did have a canny member telling me a while ago that he reckons the best 4-hole stretch in Australian golf is 14, 15, 16, 17 at Kingston Heath. And I felt comfortable debating it with him. I said, it's on the short list. I'm not sure that it's the best, but it's definitely on the short list.
Yeah, and it's got a lot of stuff that no other candidate would have. So I think it merits some thought, but certainly 16, 17 are pretty, you know, are pretty singular golf holes, the way that they're laid out over that hillside. So I think I'll still argue 13 through 16 at New South Wales versus anybody, but definitely think that's a good candidate.
Well, he liked the fact that there was a 5, a 3 and 2 fours in there and a blind drive amongst it and that iconic 17th green.
Yeah. So. Which for John Rahm was just a blind drive. You know, for us, it's a blind approach shot, but John just thought, I'll just hit it over.
Yeah, so for those who won't place that reference, the Spanish team for the 2016 World Cup that was played at Kingston Heath included John Rahm, and he obviously hits the ball a long, long way, and most of us have a blind approach into 17 at Kingston Heath, and John had complete visibility of the green because I think he had about a 40-meter flick wedge to it. So he'd driven it up and way, way over the ridge that we consider on approach. I go in there with 5-iron and 6-iron oftentimes, and occasionally more if the north wind's blowing. Mm. So not John.
Not John, no. And so what else do we want to highlight about the site? One of the things that I started to appreciate about Kingston Heath after going out and following OCCM around Bonnie Doon when they were redesigning it was, you know, this idea that kept popping up of, you're a small site, it's not about planting holes out because that actually gives you less land. It's about clearing shared fairway and short grass areas that patch of land kind of feels like it belongs to both holes. And so the sense of spaciousness is doubled. And that was something I really, you know, when you look at how Kingston Heath manages 121 acres to make you feel like the routing goes on a bit of a journey rather than just marching back and forward to maximize space. It's that openness that you can look across the course. Not only is it really beautiful heathland views, but you're getting a sense of scale and maximizing the amount of land that you can see around you. So for me, that's one of the real clever things that they've done there, Matty.
We commented on it in the last episode when you emerged from the clubhouse at Metro and you had this big expanse before you, lots of space between the first tee and the 10th tee and the 18th green, this huge green space between the course and the clubhouse. And you get a similar sense when you drive into Kingston Heath, despite the fact that it is a relatively small property, just this huge green expanse that sort of welcomes you, and you get a big look through the course. You can see lots of different holes just as you drive in, which is, as you said, a bit counterintuitive.
I think too, as well as it being great to walk out of the clubhouse and be able to see so many holes, I love that you can see just glimpses of that bright white clubhouse from the course as you move around the round at Kingston Heath. Yeah. It sort of, it gives you a reference point of direction and whatnot. And I think it's just one of those nice little 1% of things that you kind of notice as you move back towards it.
It was actually more open in decades past. Club had a fire in the 40s, and there's older members who felt that they could see the 15th green from the clubhouse, and the fire got close to the clubhouse and a lot of the vegetation on the course got scorched. So it would have been in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s, it would have been wide open and, wow, and felt really, really spacious. So yeah, some stuff survived that fire. There's interestingly three pear trees that sit to the right side of the fifth green. So the first par three that you play on the day, the par threes at Kingston Heath under the normal sequence are 5, 10, 15. There's three pear trees that are decades and decades old that still bear fruit that sit to the right side of that fifth green. And they, I don't know how they survived that fire, but they did. Club's planted, I think, two other little juniors, much as Metropolitan's got a little baby in waiting, flowering gum sitting there for the inevitable day when the big one dies. So yeah, there'll still be some pear trees there to the right of that fifth green eventually. We're talking about the 19th hole that will come in for the tournament. The club purchased some extra land a while ago, and one of the things that they did was build this extra par three, and it really relieved a little bit of pressure on the course when there was some work getting done to either one of the third or 10th or 15th, one of those short holes that tended to get a lot of pitch marks on the green, or if some other sort of maintenance work was required around the course, that 19th hole could sub in. It really, really looks like it belongs. Its scale, its bunker construction, its vegetation, its green contouring, it just looks like it's always been there, which is a great testament to the ground staff members at the club who helped to build it and who've also maintained it really, really well since, but also to OCCM, how they've designed and built that hole.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was by necessity, you know, that it was the length that it was, but in a world where you were going to play all four of those par threes on the property in a day, they're all quite different. And that hole has its own character. And I think, you know, a lot of people are only okay with 10 missing out on the tournament routing because the hole that replaces it is so bloody good.
Yeah. And it's 10's occasionally out of play for people who visit from a long way away, and that's always a bit disappointing. They can obviously walk past it and see it and occasionally not get to play it, and you're sort of left with that sense, like if you play to the alternate green at the sixth at Riviera, or if you walk past another famous hole on a course on an overseas trip, you'd have a bit of a hollow feeling. But that's assuaged to a large degree by virtue of playing that 19th. It is a good hole. It demands a precise shot, and I think we'll see that during the Australian Open. There'll be some comments regarding a need for precision. Some golfers will try and overpower the Heath, and I think you'll need to hit really, really accurate iron shots and really precise approaches if you want to score well around there. And that's a good point to keep in the back of your mind for anyone planning a trip to Kingston Heath in the next little while, whether they're an Aussie who gets to step up on a great course in their own country, or if it's someone visiting from abroad.
Matty, the 10th, we talked about missing out on the tournament routing. It's a city full of great flat ground, as you called it, football pitch par threes. The 10th seems to me to be the best of a really, really strong field. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it might be. Yeah, it's from overhead, that green looks like a bit of a diamond. So it's really, really narrow at the front, and it's pinched in by some really striking bunkering. And you get a few looks at that green as you make your way through the round early on. You can sort of crane your neck when you're on the third green and see where the pin's cut on 10. You can take a walk back from the fourth tee and or eighth tee and view the same. And it's sort of with a little bit of excitement and a little bit of trepidation that you see a really, really front pin, because you know you're just going to have to be so precise on approach.
Mm-hmm.
It narrows at the back, and you're hitting a deceptively long club in when the pin's at the back, just because that green's so deep. And you set foot on that tee and think, oh, this is a piddly little hole, and you suddenly stare down at your ball just before you swing and think, gee, I've got a lot of club in hand for such a reasonably short shot. There's a couple of guys who I know who just aim for the middle of the green, the fattest part of the diamond, the widest part of the diamond every single time. And that's a prudent play when you've got a stroke round going and you've burned up the front nine, but sort of takes the fun out of it a little bit. Sort of want to go pin hunting on that green no matter what. I've hit sand wedge into it. I've hit 6-iron into it on a day where the wind really hasn't been that helpful. It's always a fun hole to play. It is a great hole laid out on flat land. And it's interesting that it used to stand between two rows of much bigger trees. And Suter originally built that hole, sighted that hole first and said, we'll have a short hole here and then build a course around it. And that's the negative to which Mike Cocking was alluding when he was a little critical of Suter's routing methods, because there's no way on God's earth that you would stand by that as an underpinning principle of routing a course on that property these days, and yet it all works.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, you would think that, you know, that would be a hole that came 18th to connect, you know, we need one more hole, or this will be a good spot to just build something. You wouldn't have thought it was...
Yeah. I've got this little flat stretch of spare land and 9 greens there and 11 tees there. Oh, there's a couple of other tees around the place. I'll just sort of squeeze this in here.
Mm-hmm.
It really has that afterthought potential to it, and yet it became the cornerstone, which is a great story.
If you told people that there was a par 3 at Kingston Heath, you know, that was at the heart of building the course, people would say, well, of course, that's 15. Because it's the one that stands out as, you know, and on that hilltop with a bit of a lookout over the earlier holes of the back nine, it's probably the hole at Kingston Heath that feels grandest and, you know, most RM West-like, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Contrary to the appearances of it in previous decades, we posted that photo
we need to
very,
post
very
it
early on in the piece.
I saw another angle of it yesterday, and it is just a hall of conifer and gum.
That's a great description. It's astounding to look back and think that's what it played like for so long. So that's probably a cue to shout out Graham Grant, who was a longtime superintendent at Kingston Heath. We heard Clates give him a bit of a rap when he was the super at Kingswood decades ago, and they were recognised as having some of the most fierce putting surfaces in the region, and people who would go and play pennant there would sort of need a stiff drink at the end of a round there because they'd putted on glass for 4 hours. And Graham eventually came from there to Kingston Heath and was really championing that work that has allowed Kingston Heath to realise its potential. It was probably the genesis for the way it looks today. A lot of bunkering restored, wider corridors, exposed sand on the margins of fairways, clearing out trees that detracted from the architecture. Graham deserves a huge rap for that.
And then we've talked a little bit, Matty, about the par 5 holes.
7, 12, 14.
7, 12, 14. So I really like 12 for that centerline bunker and kind of a really tricky little green. As much as I would love to say 7 is my favourite par 5, but... For you, is there a standout amongst the three?
I'm surprised that they're such a memorable and different set when they all play north-south. Those who are fortunate enough to have either gone or studied Cypress Point look at that stretch of 12, 13, 14 where you've got three par fours in a row that are dog-leg right par fours, and yet they're all different holes of individual character and they're equally high quality and equally memorable. Yeah, 7, 12 and 14 all play in the same direction, and you can put the spinnaker up on days where that hot northerly wind blows and think, oh, I'm going to get home in two on all of these, and you invariably make a meal of it because you lash away without thought and don't hold those greens when you've got a tailwind. I love that centerline bunker feature on 12. You have to be really accurate with your tee shot if you're going to thread a drive down the left side, because there's red stakes down that left side that sort of creep in and grab a drive when you think they might not at times. You have to be aggressive and go down that left side or try and fly that centerline bunker if you're going to get home in two. Blowing a drive way right, sort of an admission that you're going to play it as a three-shotter and be pretty conservative. And that's an eminently sensible play for people that don't hit it that far and don't want to shoulder much risk. 7, I love, and I think I like that tiny little dip just before the green where there's lots and lots of short game interest. My memory of that hole is always coloured by Jonathan Becker, a friend who visited a long time ago, who holed his second there for an albatross. And I continually assure him that I give the plaque a little polish as I go down seven every single time, just make sure that his name is shiny as we go past that spot where he struck his six iron that found the bottom of the cup. And 14 I really, really like as well. It's different. As you said, they're all different character and they're all high quality. 14 has a great sea of sand that you traverse on a long second and some interesting little land that sits at the tail end of that ridge that cuts through the southern part of the course. You have to go down the right side and sort of thread a long shot fairway wood or hybrid or a really long iron if you hit a big drive. Sort of thread that down the right side of the hole and have the ground, let the ball trundle forward and to the left to come back onto that green. And it's always an exciting moment to sort of stick your head up once you've traversed that tiny little rise and think, oh, did I get there? Did I not? Is it kick far enough forward? So they're all great holes. I think if push came to shove, I'd probably nominate 14 as my favorite just because of the experiences I've had playing it. But they're all equally fun and equally memorable holes.
Do you have there's some debate from time to time about the third hole, the famous short par four, you know, and where it sits. Is it a really great best short four in Australia, or is it, oh no, it's missing this or it's missing that? For you, is it, I'm curious, as someone who's played it a lot, I go there and I hit driver because I'm on the third at Kingston Heath and I might not be back here for 5 years, so I'm going to hit driver. But is it for you a short four that does have you making an agonised decision on the tee, or is it a layup and pitch hole essentially if you're worried about your score?
No, I always find I'm making the decision and I'm between driver and five iron and sometimes anything in between. You want to get left off the tee. Definitely don't want to approach from the right. And sometimes people will be critical of the hole. And I think that they undersell it because it's just so difficult to hit that second shot onto the green from the right side. The broken ground and the sandy stuff on the right side of the fairway creeps in a tiny bit more than you realize from the tee. You can sort of hit something towards the flag and think, oh, that'll be fine, and get down there and find yourself in a spot of bother and think, oh, this got really complicated really quickly. Even in the right side of the short grass and the prepared fairway, getting to a pin on the right half of that green is just fiendishly difficult on occasions. And so I rate that hole very highly because of the ease with which you can approach a pin from the left when you've played a really smart shot that's well positioned on the left edge of the fairway. And something that looks a bit, doesn't look like the obvious play to just hit a five iron 45 yards left of the flag,
mm-hmm.
and still leave yourself such a reasonably long shot in on such a short hole, and to leave yourself 100 in, you know, what am I doing that for? But it is a really prudent play. Bunkers at a greenside left are really deep, deceptively difficult. Anything from the left, you hit into the slope of the green, and that gives you a chance to control your spin when you hit a full wedge, control the rollout when you hit into the slope of the green, particularly when it's firm. So there's an awful lot going on with it that sometimes escapes the eye and won't all be captured by a first-time visitor. I think it really belongs in that discussion of the best holes in the country, particularly given the nondescript site that it's on. So holes like 3 at Royal Adelaide, 10 West always sort of belongs in that discussion, and listeners will think of one or two others that are near and dear to their own hearts. But I think that 3 at Kingston Heath definitely belongs up there. I think 2 at St Andrews Beach probably takes the cake for many because it's such a dramatic hole on a huge canvas, and you can hit such an array of clubs across such a broad arc, even more so than you can at Kingston Heath. There's a great series of videos that Rich McAfee recorded in the lead up to that 2016 World Cup, where Richard's really the personification of Kingston Heath. He is one of the best guys you'll ever meet. He has won the club championship 11 times. He's on that mural that we were talking about at the outset of this episode. The club has put Rich on that mural right next to MJ Ryan, who's won 12 club championships. So Richard had spoken about the holes. I think he's done the third, the 11th. I'll put links to those videos in the show notes. And Rich probably far more eloquently and more succinctly talks about the third hole. He'll probably put one or two things, more salient points in that description of the third hole with a backdrop of a flyover and a look at the hole that'll be of interest to listeners. So yeah, I'll make sure that there's a link to that.
Very good. 10-round split between Kingston Heath, and RM West?
I think I'd give it to RM West 6-4. May, yeah, 6-4. I'll go 6-4.
Yeah. 6-4 never feels like enough, but 7-3 feels like too much.
7-3 feels like a bit of an insult.
Yeah.
There's too much good stuff at Kingston Heath to give it 3 rounds out of 10.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. Now, one last question I've got for you, Matty, about Kingston Heath. You mentioned the Test of Time and the club song to that effect. We're all hoping that you might maybe sing us out to a few lines of the Test of Time. I know you know it.
I know it. I might put a snapshot of the lyrics up. I want to retain some of our listening audience, and I think that the surest way to drive them away would be for me to attempt singing something. Definitely not going to do that. Another long-time member, Pennant manager, father of a good friend of mine, Rob Carruthers. So Jeff was a musician. I remember him. I didn't record it, but I remember him singing, leading the club song in a club function one night. I should have just got the phone out and recorded some of that. I would have played some of that had I recorded it, but maybe I'll do that at a club dinner another year.
Very good. Always good to chat golf with you, Matty.
Likewise. I hope everyone enjoys their little glimpse of Kingston Heath at the start of December. I'll put a link in the notes regarding abilities for people to visit the club. Like lots of other clubs on the Sandbelt, Kingston Heath hosts a charity event around the course once or twice every year. The Port Phillip is a notable amateur event in Sandbelt club calendars that's shared between Commonwealth and Kingston Heath. That's a cracking event to go and watch. Whenever that's staged, that's highlighted on the Golf Victoria and Golf Australia website. I'm pretty sure that admission is free for anyone wanting to go along and watch that. And the club also, like everyone else on the Sandbelt, will have a link on their website for interstate and overseas visitors to come and play the course too. Hopefully that's given people a bit of a taste of one of Australia's golfing gems and an essential course for visitors to come and savour in their trips to our shores. Really looking forward to Victoria as well, Scott, the next episode up and the other co-host of our impending Australian Open. A little less of me and a little more of you in that episode, which I'm sure our listeners will enjoy. They've had enough.
I look forward to it.
Likewise.
Cheers, mate.